The mid-1960s were troubled times in the United States, with nearly two dozen very large uprisings around racial injustice between 1964 and 1967. Clashes between police officers and black civilians often seemed to trigger these revolts, which could last many days and cost many lives. And President Lyndon Johnson wanted to understand what was going wrong. So he called a commission to study these uprisings and diagnose what was happening. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. That group of investigators, of course, was the Kerner Commission, whose 1968 report concluded that virtually all the problems that existed in, to use the parlance of the day, the ghetto, were the direct result of policies put in place by white people at the expense of black people. The commission's calls for reforms to housing, healthcare, education, and jobs access for black Americans, along with new approaches to law enforcement that sound a lot like today's demands for defunding the police, might have set the United States on a path toward a far more equitable society for Americans of all races more than 50 years ago. But Johnson essentially ignored it, and then his successors doubled down on demands for law and order that effectively punished the victims of racism for their own suffering. Jelani Cobb is a staff writer at The New Yorker, Ira A. Lippman Professor of Journalism at the Columbia Journalism School, and the recipient of Fulbright and Ford Foundation fellowships. He served as editor, along with Matthew Gariglia, of the Essential Kerner Commission Report and wrote its introduction. Jelani, welcome back to Think.
Thank you.
Will you start us off by talking about what made the mid-60s so alarming that President Johnson assembled this National Advisory Commission on Civil Disorders in July of 67? I mean, there had been racial uprisings before the 60s, of course.
Sure, there had been. But, you know, what we're looking at is the general climate of tumult in the mid-1960s. And that's heightened by the fact that there had been, you know, going back into the 19th century, you could point to these kinds of conflicts and uprisings. But the fact of what made this, I think, more notable to Lyndon B. Johnson was the fact that these things were happening as his administration was signing landmark civil rights legislation, that they were making an active push to move in a different direction. There's a war on poverty that, you know, the administration had orchestrated. And in the midst of that, there still were all of these. And you have to love the antiseptic language of bureaucracy that they use to describe these events as civil disturbances, you know? And so there are all these quote unquote civil disturbances that are happening despite the fact that there are reforms being implemented almost daily in that administration.
Is there evidence that Johnson expected the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act and the War on Poverty to preempt these kinds of uprisings?
Well, you know, I had the opportunity to talk to Fred Harris, former Senator Fred Harris, who is 90 years old and is the last surviving member of the commission. And he said that really Lyndon B. Johnson, when he would speak with him about the commission and its work, he said Johnson was kind of exasperated. For instance, he signed the Voting Rights Act, which was tremendously significant. If there's any doubt about the significance of the Voting Rights Act, you can look at the fact that we are currently fighting over it in 2021. People feel that it is essential to have the Voting Rights Act reenacted, essentially, repassed. And so he signs this in August of 1965. And just 5 days later, Watts, which was to that point the largest riot in American history, 5 days after that signing, Watts explodes. And so I think it's just the fact that these two things are occurring in such close proximity that lends, Lyndon B. Johnson a sense of frustration and a real curiosity about what needs to happen to prevent more of the same.
What were his explicit instructions to the Kerner Commission, and what sort of latitude did its members have to conduct their investigation?
So he gave a charge, which was, famously succinct. He wanted to know what happened, why had it happened, and how to prevent it from happening again. And in pursuit of that, the commission had, you know, very broad latitude, which Lyndon B. Johnson came to regret. You know, they could call witnesses and conduct interviews and, you know, do fact-finding inquiries. And it was really a very wide-ranging, you know, set of investigations that they did. And they could, you know, of course, had allocations to hire staff and bring on people who would physically write, you know, do the actual writing of the report. And so they had a pretty good degree of latitude in putting together the report.
And the point was not so much for them to probe each uprising like a crime, but to look at the broader patterns that had contributed to the potential for unrest?
Yes. And so when you say the broader patterns, though, that could mean a few different things. Lyndon B. Johnson has in his head that these events are the product, you know, or the possible product of communist provocation. And he really is interested in having a commission that's going to verify his suspicions. And so, you know, there's that part of it. On the other side of it, the commission is looking contextually at a whole array of things. And one of the things that they discover immediately, which is a kind of profound insight, and I'll come back to, you know, why I think it's significant in a minute, but they discover immediately that this, even as almost all of these uprisings are the result of police brutality or instances of police use of excessive force, that the police are not the problem, or at least not solely the problem, that they are a stand-in for a much broader set of institutional relationships that people in, and you know, here's the term they use then, people in the ghetto had with a much broader society. And so even from the outset, you know, very early on, you know, there's a divergence in perspectives between the commission or the commission members, or at least the majority of the commission members and the administration.
Was there some evidence that caused Johnson to think this was all some kind of communist plot? I mean, it sounds like a really crackpot idea in 2021.
Well, no, there wasn't, but it also wasn't entirely ridiculous. You know, going back to the 1920s, there had been, you know, the belief on the part of many communist cadre that the kind of Achilles heel of American society was the quote-unquote Negro problem, or the Negro question, as they would have called it back then. And there are kind of explicit references to wanting to use Black America as an inroads to a broader communist, you know, influence in the United States. And so, and there are certainly, you know, many ties between the far left and, you know, various civil rights movement individuals and parts of the movement itself. So it's not absurd to think that there could be some sort of connection, but in terms of evidence, there really was nothing to substantiate that this was happening.
How were these uprisings typically covered by the media of the day?
Well, I'm glad you raised that question, because one of the most insightful and really prescient things that the Kerner Commission does is look into the role of media. And they talk about the way that both problems in the ghetto are reported and the way that the uprisings that are a result of those problems are reported. And in both instances, they found that there was a kind of myopia, a kind of white myopia, because, and this is, you know, a discussion that goes on, you know, is alive and well in contemporary media, you know, institutions, but they thought that the fact that these media institutions tended to be monochromatically white had something to do with them, you know, missing the story, or people believing that they had an antagonistic slant to their coverage of Black communities. And so in 1967, where it was really kind of laudatory to be able to make the connection between the broader problems in the American society, They went a step further and even looked at media, which was an institution that people had generally not talked about in these reports. And trust me, there are a stack of other riot reports in American history.
What was the makeup of the commission itself? There were just 11 members on the panel. Is that right?
So there were 11 members. They were, and this is also pretty notable because of the findings and the kind of indictment that it makes of white racism. There were only two black people on the commission, and the other nine were white. Of the 11 members, 10 of them were men. And so, you know, only one woman. And so it was mostly white men who sat around a table and tried to understand what was happening in underserved, what we now call underserved black communities in 1965, 1966, 1967.
Martin Luther King died just weeks after the Kerner Commission report was released. Did he have a chance to read and respond to it?
There's no indication that he did, but one of the things that happened with the commission is that it came out in March of 1968, and King died, of course, in April of 1968. And because of the really just the conflagrations, you know, the inferno of American cities that happened in the aftermath of King's assassination, it became easy for people to think that the Kerner Commission report had been about that. You know, people have forgotten that the report came out before any of that happened. And they were looking at 1965 to 1967. Now, the irony of it is, of course, that this was a report that was meant to review events, but it has become more well known for its predictive ability or what it had to say about the future. Because in 1980, when there were the uprisings in Miami that you know came as a result of a police homicide where a motorist was beaten, black motorist was beaten to death, you know, Kerner, you know, was more relevant, was seen as more relevant. In 1992, when the Rodney King uprisings happened, people turned back to Kerner, and that was nearly on the 25th anniversary of the report. And so it's nearly a quarter century old. In 2014 in Ferguson, in 2021 in Minneapolis, and in the other instances in between, we keep going back to the Kerner Commission report and what it had to say and what it was trying to tell us.
To the extent that policing played a role in triggering these uprisings, despite that the fact that the Kerner Commission was clear that they were not the entire reason for these uprisings, what kind of recommendations did the Kerner Committee have for restoring, or maybe the better word is initiating, better relationships between local police and black communities?
So one of the things that they said, you know, which I think just jumped out in the context of reading this, because we started work on this in June of last year. And so it was in the immediate aftermath. There were still things on fire in the aftermath of George Floyd's death, as we sat down and started analyzing this report and editing it. And so they said that black communities or quote unquote ghettos were over-policed. And what they meant by that was that there were too many instances in which people interacted with law enforcement around things that were not really law enforcement concerns. And they said people call the police for everything, or the police are sent to handle every single problem. And as a result, you have all of these chances where something can go wrong or something can go disastrously wrong. They need to create alternate structures for people to get access to social services that do not involve someone with a firearm on their hip. That was essentially what the Defund the Police people were arguing in June of 2020 as we were working on this. And it was kind of an astounding insight. And, you know, of course, there the idea is that there needed to be, you know, different kinds of training in police departments. They also made the point that police departments needed to be integrated, as very many of them were not at the time, and you know, people were being policed by individuals from different backgrounds, which you know, related to kind of cultural problems and so on, and you know, the culture of police departments, a lot of things that you would anticipate a report like this saying. But the idea that they essentially articulated the crux of defund the police in 1968 was really astounding to me.
What did the Kerner Commission conclude about the contributions that substandard housing for many Black Americans made to this kind of unrest?
So, you know, to look at their approach, or to take their approach, they looked at what had happened and said that it was the culmination of institutional failures, many institutions in healthcare, in education, in employment, and in housing. And you know, one of the things that that distinguished the report is its thoroughness. And so they walk through the history of housing reform and housing access in the 20th century, and the development of slums and the ways in which immigrants are able to move out of those slums. And by the 1960s, there's a burgeoning suburban America that's taking place that Black people are largely excluded from. And it's this exclusion which has left people in a kind of mired in despair and hopelessness, as well as substandard physical conditions of housing. And it becomes a kind of silent assault that contributes to the anger that explodes when a police incident happens.
This is an interesting place to spend a little time, because I think buried in it is an explanation for something that seems to really trip up some white Americans who are upset at the destruction of property in Black communities. People ask, like, why would demonstrators harm their own neighborhoods? The Kerner Commission recognized that Black residents of many cities had never been allowed to feel like their neighborhoods belonged to them in the first place.
Sure. Sure. And, you know, when people would say, why are they burning up their own communities, they say those are not their communities. And so they have, you know, very little ownership stake in, you know, the places where they are. They have very little mobility, very little access, you know, to ownership. And then, you know, there are kind of very few standards to which the people who actually do own property there are held. And you know, that is part of that's part of the equation too.
And white flight had actually begun before these uprisings that were investigated by Kerner.
That's a very important point. Yes. So the standard narrative that we have about white flight is that white people began moving out of the cities as a result of riots and unrest and uprisings and crime rates, which spiked in the mid late 1960s. And, you know, white people were doing what any sensible, rational actor would, which is finding a better place to live under those circumstances. But when you go back to all of the cities that had these major uprisings in the 1960s, what you see is that the white population begins to decline more than a decade earlier. And so, you know, in Baltimore, in Detroit, in Newark, in Watts, the white populations declined between 1940 and 1950. And the big difference is, you know, what happens after World War II when people begin to open up housing opportunities. And those numbers decline again between 1950 and 1960. And so the riots are really a result of what's happening in the cities. The tax bases are diminishing. In many instances, the industrial base, this is, you know, what happened in Baltimore, where a lot of jobs moved from the inner city or inside the perimeter of Baltimore to Baltimore County, which is where the white population was moving. And so you wound up with these urban centers that were bereft, decreasing tax base, decreasing opportunity, and increasingly concentrated with low-income people who also happened to be Black. And so it became a convenient way to avoid the complex dynamics that were going on, to simply say that the riots happened and people wanted to get away from all the violence that was happening.
So the Kerner Commission was invested in the idea that keeping schools well and fully integrated was a good solution to the problem of inequitable access to decent education. But the commission also acknowledged like that wasn't going to happen anytime soon. What kinds of prescriptions did it make for improving the kind of education available to most Black students?
So I think it's important to kind of go back to the points that they make about integration. And how that had come to bear in the first place. So part of this is the influence of Roy Wilkins, who is the president of the NAACP. And so it's not surprising that a decade and a half after the Brown versus Board of Education decision, they're saying that there has to be educational reform and educational equality. But they also are talking about the need to invest in schools, the need to create actual functional education within the communities that where people are, because even by the mid-1960s, the momentum of school integration has been thwarted. And, you know, it is effectively reversed by the 1970s. And so they recognize this and say that there has to be an increased willingness to fund education in the communities where people are.
And of course, education would play a significant role in job access just at this moment in 20th century U.S. history when we were deindustrializing in a lot of places.
That's right. And so one of the things that is important, I think, or notable here is that this is really, and I hate to use the cliche, but it's really the perfect storm of situations that all collide, because not only are Black people excluded from, you know, the urban labor force, this is the exact moment at which those jobs cease to be or become decreasingly accessible even to white people. You know, where we begin, you know, the tides of deindustrialization in American cities and albeit in the United States overall. And so if we look at the 20th century, we can really see the explosion of the white middle class, which, you know, begins in the 1930s, but really as a post-war phenomena, that is a product of a specific moment in which there is a public will and a political will to create things like highways, to create things like housing subsidies that allow people to allow developers to build subdivisions where suburbia takes place, where there are these transformative moments that really secure the future of a part of the population. And Black people are effectively locked out of that because of public policy, racism, and so on. And in looking at this, we see exactly the kind of prescription for what we got. And these jobs become even more difficult to access for Black people as it becomes more scarce to the whole population. And so this is in some ways a harbinger of what we begin to see in a broader dynamic much later in the country.
All right, Jelani, you've already told us that President Johnson expected that perhaps the Kerner Commission would come to some different conclusions about the real source of this racial unrest that was roiling American cities. How did he, in fact, receive the commission's report and recommendations? What did he do with that document?
Very little. He did very little with it. And I think, you know, because LBJ was a masterful politician, it is striking that he had a commission that got away from him. You know, the stereotype about commissions is that, you know, you appoint a commission when you don't actually want to do anything. And, you know, or the belief that, you know, commissions are kind of a slam dunk for the person who puts them together. And, you know, this commission really did not turn out to be that. But even before that happened, you know, he had begun to get wind of where some of these conversations were going and what some of the votes had been and the lines of inquiry that had been approved by the commission. And so the first thing that he did was decline to meet with the commission when it issued its findings. And, you know, they'd wanted, you know, 6 more months to oversee the beginning of the implementation of some of what they wanted. And that didn't happen. And then he essentially ignored it. And, you know, he made no real reference to it and pretended that it didn't happen, that it didn't exist. The reason that we know about it was that the commission very wisely decided to publish their findings. And, you know, they went with a independent trade publisher who put out the book version of the report, which rocketed up the New York Times bestseller list when it came out. And so in a strange sense, you know, the person who created the commission ignored it, or essentially orphaned it, and it found this new life in the public as opposed to in the political sphere.
Were there a lot of people excited about the, it would have been a logical conclusion to assume that something was going to be done about all these problems Koerner had identified?
Yes and no. The reason I say it in that way was that people within the administration thought this was disastrous for LBJ. And, you know, as a matter of fact, you know, LBJ's advisors were kind of buzzing in his ear long before it came out, you know, that, you know, we have to suppress this or minimize it because they thought there would be a revolt among white voters to hear such stark language about racism being deeply complicit in the creation of the problems that they were all lamenting. And, you know, so there was, you know, that part of it. For other people who had been making these arguments all along for years or decades, this seemed a vindication, you know, that people understood, you know, had thoroughly examined and come to an understanding of what was happening in these communities. But also, we're in the midst of 1968, which is a historically tumultuous year in American society. And so in order for these recommendations to have been enacted, one, they would have had to have had some favor with the administration, which they did not. And two, a Democrat would have had to win in 1968, which did not happen either. And so the new direction that the country took under Richard Nixon, law and order, was decidedly unsympathetic to the perspective that had been articulated in the Koerner Commission report.
Did Nixon essentially argue that fixing these things that ailed Black America was like rewarding people for having protested in ways that sometimes turned violent?
Yes. And essentially, what law and order meant was that people could wash their hands of any of the complexities or the frustrations or the difficulties and just say these people just need to live more decently and adhere to, you know, what law enforcement says. And that was politically very appealing, you know, for lots of people. And so, you know, as I write in the introduction, that really set the tide, set the tone of criminal justice discussions for three decades or more. And even as you get into the Clinton era, where, you know, there's a kind of putative liberalism, it is so distinct from the liberalism of the 1960s as to be unrecognizable. And so, you know, and of course, a Democratic president, you know, Bill Clinton signed the 1994 crime bill. So really, Nixon is the tip of a very big wave that moves policy and public attitudes in a completely different direction.
I know that you were quite familiar with the Koerner Commission report before the summer of 2020, but I'm curious, what was it like to go back through it with a fine-tooth comb, given the climate in this country a year and a half ago?
Yes, yeah, so I'd read this report for the first time in undergrad, or read part of it for the first time in undergrad. And you know, then, you know, encountered it again in grad school and various other points, you know, where I've flipped through the report. But I really have to say that I was astounded by how much they saw coming when I sat down and read the entire report, the unexpurgated version of the report. And, you know, just how when you get 11 people in a room and then they have, you know, various other committees and people that are reporting to them and subgroupings and so on, it seems like what you work toward is a kind of institutional blandness. But the opposite happens here, that they are more perceptive, they're more prescient, and they're more audacious in making the arguments that they make than you would anticipate. And I think that really stood out to me, as well as a few other things. You kind of note the places where it's worn and things that don't hold up, which is to be assumed for anything that's 53 years old. But I really was impressed with, even more than I had been before, with how relevant the report remains.
So, I mean, you can look at the Kerner Commission report and be astonished at how prescient they were. And in some ways, it makes it all the more tragic because so many of these recommendations were just left to die on the vine.
So many were, yeah. And they were essentially calling for a comprehensive reworking of America's relationships with its cities and with its Black population. And in the best of times, that would have required a monumental political will and a very significant political mandate to achieve. And instead, what we have is Kerner as almost the last mile marker of 1960s liberalism. This is the moment at which people believe that government has a role in securing a better role, a better life for its citizens, and a better society for us all. That there's a kind of idealism about what can be done through, policy and goodwill, and the relationship of government and its citizens. And then that all goes in a different direction. And it's almost like a finger pointing us down a road that we don't pursue.
So, are you saying that a report like this could not make these conclusions today, regardless of who was president and what their intentions were?
I think, interestingly, that when we look at the conversation about critical race theory, or what people are calling critical race theory, that it might be even harder for these kinds of conclusions to be presented in a government document now. I remember during the Obama era, when the Department of Justice put out the report saying that white nationalists were a growing threat in American society, and it created a maelstrom on Capitol Hill. Who was going to think that politicians would come to the defense of white nationalists? But that happened. And now, in the ensuing decade, we've only seen how much more relevant that was. And that was a kind of discreet report about violent militias. To talk about something that indicts the society at large, and the habits and attitudes and policies and history that have inculcated and reinforced racial hierarchies, I just think that it would be astounding to see something like that happen now.
So, for somebody who maybe is encountering the Kerner Commission report for the first time now, what do you suggest they do with this document? What is the purpose of reading it?
So I think that there are a couple of purposes. One is that it's a great way of contextualizing the problems that we're seeing right now, the issues that we're talking about, and where kind of insightful thinking on it started, and what it has to tell us today. The other is that I don't view these things solely through the lens of despair. I think that change actually is possible, and I think it's important that people organize and they fight and they remain optimistic. And they remain informed, so that when those moments of possibility do arrive, they're able to seize upon them and move forward in ways that are beneficial. And I think the Kerner Commission report is really helpful in that regard.
In just a few seconds, since you and I are in the business of journalism, do you have a favorite recommendation that Kerner made for media?
Oh, well, the first one that was that the diversity. I think the media needed to diversify, which I think is crucially important, and something that I fight for, even at this moment. So, that's one of the best of them.
Jelani Cobb is a staff writer at The New Yorker and Ira A. Lipman Professor of Journalism at Columbia University School of Journalism. He served as editor along with Matthew Gariglia of the Essential Kerner Commission report, and he wrote its introduction. Jelani, thanks very much for making time to talk with us.
Thank you.
You can like our page on Facebook. We're on Twitter at KERA Think. If you want the podcast, it's free wherever you get podcasts. Just search for KERA Think and subscribe. Or listen on our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.